Isaiah chapter 17 and 18, the 14th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on October 28, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Isaiah's chapters 17 and 18. Yes, 17 and 18. We're in this section in Isaiah where there are a series of oracles. So far we've had three of the oracles. The first one was with respect to Babylon, the second one was with respect to Philistia, and the third one was with respect to Moab. And we've got several more oracles that are coming up in this section. This section is about 10 chapters long. And in each one of these, the oracle contains some kind of prediction of destruction. But in each of the oracles, there is also some basis for ongoing hope. It's an interesting combination, and it's an interesting effect that's created. This next one is an oracle concerning Damascus, which is the capital of Aram. Aram would have been in what is the present-day Syria, just northeast of Israel. Damascus, at the time, would have been a major trading center because trade going from Mesopotamia to Egypt would have gone through Damascus. So it was wealthy, it was large, and it was an important urban area. Damascus is the capital of Aram. But this oracle is going to quickly shift from talking about Damascus to talking about the northern kingdom, Israel. The first three verses. The oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus is about to be removed from being a city, and it will become a fallen ruin. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They will be for flocks to lie down in, and there will be no one to frighten them. The fortified city will disappear from Ephraim, and sovereignty from Damascus, and the remnant of Aram, they will be like the glory of the sons of Israel, declares the Lord of hosts. So it starts out saying that this is an oracle concerning Damascus. And it says that Damascus is going to be destroyed. It will cease to be a city, essentially. It says it will be removed from being a city. And it's just going to be fallen ruins. So the prediction is that Damascus will be completely destroyed. In verse 2, it says the cities of Aroer are forsaken. And it's not clear what Aroer is. Apparently, there were quite a few cities in the ancient Middle East by that name, but none of them were located in the vicinity of Damascus. The Septuagint reading for this says forever and ever. So instead of a proper noun, Aroer, it's forever and ever that those cities will be forsaken. That's a possibility. That reading would only be different from the Masoretic text reading by one tittle, which is a corner on a letter. So it's possible that that's what's happened. In the Jewish Encyclopedia, for reasons that I do not know, it translates it, the city and the cities thereof. So it would read, and the cities thereof are forsaken. They will be for flocks to lie down in. And I'm not sure what kind of textual change that would have required to get that meaning. In any case, Damascus will be destroyed, and apparently other cities will be destroyed, all of them presumably in Aram. And once that is done, and those cities are destroyed and abandoned, They will be for flocks to lie down in, and there will be no one to frighten them. We've seen that image used previously with respect to Israel. That is an area that is so desolated, is so destroyed, that there is nothing left but some flocks and shepherds. Everybody else is gone. There's nobody there to bother them. Then it switches. Verse 3 is a switch because it says the fortified city will disappear from Ephraim. Ephraim was the capital of the northern kingdom, Israel. So what's being predicted here is that Israel also will be destroyed. And it says the fortified city will disappear. Israel, unlike Judah, was very heavily fortified. There were a number of cities in Israel that had very stout city walls. Israel had more money. Israel was more prosperous, had more people. And it's much better fortified. And they took pride in being as well fortified as they were. But this prediction is that the fortified city will disappear from Ephraim. So that's all going to be leveled. Then it says, and sovereignty from Damascus. So this is being paired up. Northern Israel, all of its fortifications will be destroyed, and the sovereignty will disappear from Aram. And then it goes on, and the remnant of Aram, they will be like the glory of the sons of Israel. So this is the next couplet. Whatever is left of Aram, it will be reduced to the status of the sons of Israel. And we'll see in the next verse that that's much diminished. So this verse 3 is putting together the fates of Israel with the fate of Aram. And from now on, there will be no more mention of Aram or Damascus anymore. The rest of it is talking about Israel. I'm not sure why these two are paired together so closely and why Aram doesn't get more print, but they were allied. We know that they were allied and they wanted Judah to join them in their alliance. And Isaiah had warned that Judah ought not join them in that alliance. So they were allied, and it could be that because they were allied that they've been coupled here in this oracle. Next section. Now it will come about in that day that the glory of Jacob will fade, and the fatness of his flesh will become lean. It will be even like the reaper gathering the standing grain, as his arm harvests the ears. Or it will be like one gleaning ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Yet gleanings will be left in it like the shaking of an olive tree, two or three olives on the topmost bough, four or five on the branches of a fruitful tree, declares the Lord, the God of Israel. In that day, man will have regard for his Maker, and his eyes will look to the Holy One of Israel, and he will not have regard for the altars, the work of his hands, nor will he look to that which his fingers have made, even the Asherim and incense stands. In that day their strong cities will be like forsaken places in the forest, or like branches which they abandoned before the sons of Israel. And the land will be a desolation. For you have forgotten the God of your salvation and have not remembered the rock of your refuge. Therefore you plant delightful plants and set them with vine slips of a strange God. In the day that you plant it, you carefully fence it in, and in the morning you bring your seed to blossom. But the harvest will be a heap in a day of sickness and incurable pain. In that day is a phrase that we have seen many times before. We'll see it many times to come. It appears three times in this passage. The glory of Jacob is going to fade. So Jacob, which had enjoyed a significant prosperity for about 100 years or so, that Jacob being the northern kingdom, that is going to fade. And it uses a couple of metaphors to capture this fading of the glory of Jacob. The first is the fatness of his flesh will become lean. So it starts out with this image of someone who is well-fed, rounded out, and then that flesh, the fatness of that flesh, it becomes lean. So someone who has gone through a stark reduction in calories. The next image is one of harvest. That the northern kingdom is going to be like, and this is, my translation is like the reaper gathering the standing grain, but it could be like the harvest gathering the standing grain. In any case, the image is one of the harvest of crops when they are ready to be brought in. So what looks beautiful, fruitful, abundant, is all going to be, that's all going to be changed. It's all going to be removed. So the first picture is like someone coming through and cutting all of the grain, and they're carrying the grain in their arms, carrying that away from the field. So a field that looked full and plentiful now is beginning to look bare. It likens it to one gleaning the ears of grain in the Valley of Rephaim. The Valley of Rephaim would have been southwest of Jerusalem, not too far southwest of Jerusalem, but it was known for its productivity, agricultural productivity. So the northern kingdom will be like that valley after it's been harvested. Everything's been taken off of it. Then it likens it to an olive tree, that the tree has been shaken to get all of the olives down to harvest and pick them up. And what remains is only two or three olives on the topmost bough, or four or five on the branches of what was a fruitful tree, but now all that fruit has been removed. So that's what the northern kingdom is going to be like. It's going to be this very productive area is going to be stripped. This very productive area is going to look like it's impoverished. When that happens, in that day, when that happens, man will have regard for his maker. So it's talking about a change of heart. It's talking about a point in time when, presumably in response to what has happened, in response to this devastation that sweeps through the northern kingdom, man will have regard for his maker. That's significant because if you remember back at the very beginning of the book of Isaiah, his first charge against the people of Judah, and I think it was that we could extend that to the people of Israel as well, is that they took God for granted. They didn't know who took care of them. It starts out with an ox and a donkey. They know who feeds them in their manger. They know who puts the food out for them. But you don't recognize who cares for you. Well, here, after the devastation of the northern kingdom, man will have regard for his maker. And I think that's the same idea. That is, we were made, as human beings, we were made by God. And as such, we ought to recognize that fact and acknowledge and pay honor to the one who made us. After this devastation, man will have regard for his maker, and his eyes will look to the Holy One of Israel. That phrase, the Holy One of Israel, shows up 31 times in the Old Testament as a whole, and all but six of those occurrences are in Isaiah. So Isaiah likes that phrase. And I'll point out that of the other six, I think two or three of them are in Jeremiah, which borrows heavily from Isaiah. So this is a favorite expression of Isaiah's, and it seems to indicate the one true God as opposed to those imitators, the others who would pretend to be gods. So there's going to be a change of heart that will come about. Furthermore, or to extend that description of that change of heart, he will not have regard for the altars, the work of his hands. So he'll recognize that the altars that he's made, the idols that he's made, those are all of his own creation. Those are all his own doing. That's not the God that made him. Those are the gods that he made. And man will reach the point where he recognizes that distinction, that the gods that he's been worshiping are the ones that he has made, not the God that made him. And that includes the ashram and the incense stand. So it's all of the religious apparatus of the Canaanite worship. Verse 9 is a difficult one, and there are alternate readings for this. You might have this in your margin. It says, in that day, their strong cities will be like forsaken places in the forest. Now that word that's translated forsaken places, in my margin, it gives the Greek reading. And so the Septuagint reading here is the deserted places of the Amorites and the Hivites, which they abandoned. So the Septuagint has taken this to mean their strong cities will look like the cities of the Canaanites that were abandoned when the Israelites first came into the land. And I think that's plausible. It's plausible that that was the original reading. The last half of the verse also has a textual problem. It says, or like branches which they abandoned before the sons of Israel. The term branches here, it only occurs, I think this only occurs once in the Old Testament, and it's not clear what the meaning of this term is, but it's been translated here, branches. John Oswalt, one of the commentators that I've been consulting, it can mean, he says, the uppermost parts. And so he translates this as, or like the high places. He takes that to be indicative of the high places, which they, that is, and presumably that's the Canaanites, which they abandoned before the sons of Israel. So that's all plausible, but that verse is very difficult because of the textual issues. In any case, the land will be completely devastated as a result of this, of what's coming. Why? Verse 10 explains why this devastation is coming. You have forgotten the God of your salvation, and you have not remembered the rock of your refuge. And we'll have comments about this at the end. Therefore, you plant delightful plants and set them with vine slips of a strange God. Now, this is interesting. There is a Greek religion in which they worshiped the god Adonis, and they had a ritual in which they would plant a plant in with the rest of their crops that they had planted, and they would do something to force that one plant to go through a life cycle quickly. And in so doing, they believed that they were bringing fertility to the crop as a whole. Does that make sense? And it is believed that this particular religion, Greek religion, was borrowed from the Levant, someplace in Palestine or in Lebanon. And so it's believed that that's what's being referred to here, a practice, a religious practice, in which they forced the growth of one plant to bring fertility to the crop as a whole. So it says, therefore you plant delightful plants and set them with vine slips of a strange god. In the day that you plant it, you carefully fence it in, and in the morning you bring your seed to blossom. But the harvest will be a heap in a day of sickliness and incurable pain. So this religious ritual that they are depending on, counting on, producing productive crops, what is actually going to happen is that those crops will turn out to be a complete waste. God is going to guarantee their failure. The harvest will be a heap in a day of sickliness and incurable pain. So the thing that they're counting on, the thing that's going to save them, is the very thing that will let them down. God's going to guarantee that what they've been relying on will not protect them, will not give them security. The next section now is a change, and we're going to have to figure out what kind of a change it is. Alas, the uproar of many peoples who roar like the roaring of the seas and the rumbling of nations, who rush on like the rumbling of mighty waters. The nations rumble on like the rumbling of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away and be chased like chaff in the mountains before the wind, or like whirling dust before a gate. At evening time, behold, there is terror. Before morning, they are no more. Such will be the portion of those who plunder us, and the lot of those who pillage us. So it's talking about the uproar of many nations. We've got this multinational entity of some sort, and it's all in an uproar. He likens it to the rumbling of mighty waters. In my mind, that conjures up the waves crashing into the shore, into the rocks, and spraying up. It can be a thunderous sound. The ocean is a powerful thing. So he's likening this to that kind of powerful surge. And so the uproar of many peoples is that kind of thing. The nations rumble on like the rumbling of many waters. I suspect that some of you remember back to the late 60s and early 70s when large numbers of people would gather in anti-war activity of some sort or other. And if you've ever seen that, it is a bizarre thing to behold, to see a kind of mob mentality. And you can see that there's a lot of power there. You can also see that it's not entirely predictable where that thing's going to go. But it looks ominous. It can look very ominous. It can be very frightening. And some of you may have experienced that sort of thing. I experienced it on a small scale. My wife and I went and saw a movie this week, if I can remember the name of it. It's one about the hostages in Iran. Argo. There's a scene there where they are trying to capture the taking of the embassy initially. And they show the mob forming and the mob getting mad. And eventually some members of the mob climb up over the fence and jump into the compound. And then they open the doors, and then you've got a flood of people coming in, and then they're going to the doors of the embassy. A mob like that can be kind of sea-like, where just floods in. And it's a scary thing. It can have a lot of power. So that seems to be the image that he's conjuring up here, is that kind of an enormous multinational mob that is up in arms about something. It's not clear what it's up in arms about, but it's up in arms about something. And it's acting in a way that's reminiscent of the sea. But we see in the last half of verse 13, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away and be chased like the chaff in the mountains before the wind, or like whirling dust before a gale. So what looks very ominous and menacing, with one rebuke from God, it just dissolves. It just dissipates into nothingness. 14, it says, at evening time, behold, there is terror. So in evening time, everybody's scared. It looks truly ominous. It's frightening. but before morning, they are no more. What looks like it is overwhelming, unstoppable, in an instant, it's gone. Such will be the portion of those who plunder us and the lot of those who pillage us. Presumably then, what's being talked about, the us here is presumably Israel. And so the uproar of many nations seems to be against Israel in some way. And their portion, the portion of those who would come and do harm to Israel, who would plunder and pillage Israel, will be that. They will dissipate and be like chaff in the mountains before the wind.
Yeah, are you talking about Judah being the one that they're coming to pillage?
I'm putting them, Israel and Judah, together here. The oracle is actually with respect to Aram and Israel, but it is switched. It's primarily about Israel. And the us here, I take to be Isaiah saying us as a nation. So Judah and Israel. Okay, I'll come back to that in my closing comments. The next chapter. Alas, O land of whirring wings, which lies beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends envoys by the sea, even in papyrus vessels on the surface of the waters. Go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide. All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on earth, as soon as the standard is raised on the mountains, you will see it. And as soon as the trumpet is blown, you will hear it. For thus the Lord has told me. I will look from my dwelling place quietly, like dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, as soon as the bud blossoms and the flower becomes a ripening grape, then he will cut off the sprigs with pruning knives and remove and cut away the spreading branches. They will be left together for mountain birds of prey and for the beasts of the earth, and the birds of prey will spend the summer feeding on them. And all the beasts of the earth will spend harvest time on them. At that time, a gift of homage will be brought to the Lord of hosts from a people tall and smooth, even from a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, even Mount Zion. This is a very difficult chapter. It's hard to know what's going on here. So we'll just kind of work through some of the difficulties. The land of the whirring wings. There are two primary interpretations of this that have been presented. Three. The first is that the whirring wings is insects. And the land that's being talked about, it says, is beyond Cush, beyond the rivers of Cush. If you can visualize a map of Africa, there is Egypt. The southern part of Egypt, then, is Cush. So we're talking about the land just south of that, presumably. Now, I should point out that at about this time, at about in the low 700s, Egypt was taken over by a dynasty from Cush. The tribes in Cush came and conquered Egypt and became the rulers of Egypt. I'm not sure exactly how that plays in here. There are several proposals that have been made as to how that plays in here, but I'm not sure whether it does or not. So the whirring wings, one possibility is this is the land of big insects. And apparently in the ancient world, that part of Africa was known for having big insects. The second possibility is the whirring wings is talking about sails on a ship. We do see later reference to papyrus vessels. And those papyrus vessels typically were driven by wind with sails. And it was common practice in the ancient world for sails to be likened unto wings. So potentially that's the connection. The other possibility is that in some manuscripts, the word that here is translated whirring wings is the word shadows. And the idea there would be the part of the world where sometimes your shadow is on one side of you and other times the shadow is on the other side of you. In other words, the equator. Those are the three proposals that I found. I don't like any of them, but I don't have a better one. Which I've already talked about, the rivers of the Kush, which lie beyond the rivers of the Kush. So we're talking about this land that is presumably in northern Africa. Now, it could be talking about Kush as literally as an area, or there are instances where this expression Kush was used to mean the ends of the earth. So like Timbuktu. It's just way out there at the end of the world. So that's a possibility. Now, this land sends envoys by the sea, even in papyrus vessels on the surface of the waters. So there are messengers going out from this land, envoys going out from this land by the sea. Well, typically, generally, that expression would indicate on the Mediterranean or something. But apparently there is precedence for the Nile being referred to as a sea, as was the Tigris and Euphrates were sometimes referred to as the sea. So it's possible that these envoys are going along the Nile, going on a river. It says even in papyrus vessels. Apparently, they did not use papyrus vessels to go out into the Mediterranean, but they were used to go up and down the Nile. Okay, so it's not clear where these envoys are going. They're going by water somewhere. They could be going to Egypt. They could be going beyond. It's not clear. Then he says, "Go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth." Now, unfortunately, the words that are translated tall and smooth, it's not clear what they mean. Those words only occur twice in the Old Testament, once here in verse 2 and once at the end of this chapter in verse 7. The Septuagint translates these words as lifted up and harsh. So rather than tall and smooth, it's lifted up and harsh. So, I don't know who they are. It goes on to say, a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation. So, whoever they are, this is a big deal. They are powerful and mean. Then it says, we've got another clue, whose land the rivers divide. The unfortunate thing about this clue, like a lot of these clues, is it doesn't help much. As far as I know, there's no land that's described this way routinely. In fact, this is the only place that this phrase appears in chapter 18, and again, it appears two times. And as you think about it, any land that has two rivers or more is divided by those rivers. It's possible that what it has in mind is, for instance, the delta of Egypt, that would make some sense. You have lots of rivers dividing that whole area. Another possibility would be Mesopotamia, which is divided by two big rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris. But I don't know. Oh, and then the question is, are these messengers going from the land that lies beyond the rivers of the Kush out to another people? Or are these the same people are the people who inhabit the land that lies beyond the rivers of the Cush the same as the tall and smooth nation? I'm inclined to think that these messengers are going out to another nation, but it's really hard to sort that out. Okay. It then says in verse 3, all you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on earth, as soon as a standard is raised on the mountains, you will see it. And as soon as the trumpet is blown, you will hear it. So all of the inhabitants of the world are going to be witnesses to a standard being raised. And we've seen that phrase before, I think three times now in Isaiah. And in two instances, that was an ominous thing in which the nations were gathering to prepare to invade Palestine. And then the other occasion, it was a happy occasion when the people of Israel were being gathered back. This seems to fit into the former category. This is an ominous thing. The standard is being raised. So presumably then, what's happening is the messages that are going out are organizing an army. And the standard is being raised, and this army is going to assemble. For the Lord has told me, I will look from my dwelling place quietly, like dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. I like this image a lot. So what we've got going on, and I think that what the section we've just read is linked to the end of chapter 17. So these mobs, this mob that's coming into being, that's being assembled, there are messengers going out to and fro all over the place, gathering together, I think, a multinational mob. And it looks terrifying. I think that's what we're supposed to understand. But as terrifying as it looks, what is God's response? I will look for my dwelling place quietly. He's not perturbed. This is not a concern to him. It may look horrendous. It may look really, really scary. But God's not concerned. He goes on to say, like dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. So he's likening, I think, his activity to dazzling heat and a cloud of dew, both of which are absolutely essential for the growth of crops. So he has been involved in the growth of these crops. But when they're getting close to the time of harvest, it goes on, for before the harvest, as soon as the bud blossoms and the flower becomes a ripening grape, then he will cut off the sprigs with pruning knives and remove and cut away the spreading branches. So as soon as it's getting close to harvest time, he's not going to allow it to reach the point of actual maturity. Before it reaches actual maturity, he's going to go and he's going to cut off the ripening grape and the sprigs with his pruning knife and all of the spreading branches. So this thing that looks like it is going gangbusters is of no concern to God. In fact, he was the one that made this thing come together. It was his activity that grew these plants that now he's going to nip in the bud. So he's not concerned. In verse 6, they will be left together for mountain birds of prey and for the beasts of the earth. And the birds of prey will spend the summer feeding on them, and all the beasts of the earth will spend harvest time on them. So the result is going to be all of this waste on the ground that the birds and the animals will feast on for an extended period of time. Then verse 7 is a very interesting turn. At that time, a gift of homage will be brought to the Lord of hosts, from a people tall and smooth, even from a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide. To the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, even Mount Zion. So this people, this powerful and frightening people, they will give homage to the Lord of hosts. They will bring gifts to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, to Mount Zion. So in the end, they will be turned, and they will recognize the God that is there. Okay. Obviously, this is tough to sort out. It's hard to know what's going on here. At this point, I'm inclined to connect this to what I had said earlier with respect to the oracle to Babylon. But let me back up just a little bit. It is possible that what's being talked about here is the invasion of Israel by the Assyrians. We do know that when the Assyrians came in 701, that they made it as far as the outskirts of Jerusalem. They were within eyeshot of the city, easy eyeshot of the city. And what happened is overnight, there were, according to the account later in Isaiah, there were 180,000 people, Assyrian soldiers, that were dead, strewn out over the landscape. And the rest of the army fled. So that could be what it's talking about when it's talking about God nipping this harvest in the bud, that God took that action with respect to Assyria. My problem with that is, primarily, I don't know how to fit that in with verse 7, the response of this same people giving homage to God. I don't know of anything in history that would suggest that the Assyrians did that. Maybe that's separate in time from when they had attacked Israel. I'm not sure. I am at this point inclined to see this actually being connected with the oracle with respect to Babylon, and I am inclined to think that this is something that is actually yet to come, but it is very difficult. Okay. This oracle with respect to Damascus, if in any way in chapter 17 is talking about Damascus of the time that Isaiah is writing, it was destroyed, and it may have been destroyed several times, but it came under attack from the Assyrians starting in 733 and continuing into 721. By 721, Damascus was pretty well leveled. So if this refers to the actual destruction of Damascus, then presumably this was a prediction written before the destruction of Damascus, which would have put it before 720. We've already seen an oracle that was written at the time that King Ahaz died, which would put it at 716. That suggests that these oracles are not in the order in which Isaiah received them. My guess is that Isaiah received these oracles over a period of time, and as he received them, he probably disseminated them. I don't know whether it was in written form or whether it was in oral form, but he probably disseminated them. And then at some later point, they were collected and put into the book of Isaiah. And as he put them into the book of Isaiah, he has not put them in the book in the order in which he received them, but rather in some other order. And that's something that we'll need to talk about when we get to the end of this section, is what is the organizing principle in throughout this section, chapters 13 through 23. What is the organizing principle here? Why are they in the order that they're in? And that's a difficult question. When we get to this section, I'll give a stab at it, but I want to give myself more time. I haven't figured it out yet. But I find that interesting that might be the case. There are a couple of things that are kind of tangential to the section that I think are worth talking about. The first one is, I'm tapping into the verse 14 of chapter 17, where it says, such will be the portion of those who plunder us and the lot of those who pillage us. It does seem to me that God has so ordained things that the nation of Israel, that is the descendants of Abraham, play a unique role in history, and God plays a unique role in the life of that people. And that it is a principle that goes back to the time of Abraham, when God told Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. That God is protective of that people, of that historic people. And that verse 14 is, in a sense, restating that affirmation on the part of God, that God will protect them. If a people comes in to plunder and pillage Israel, they will suffer the wrath of God. They will be punished for that. I was trying to think through that a little bit. It's difficult to sort out exactly what should be our attitude to the nation of Israel, to the Jews. That is, for us who are Gentile believers. I find it interesting that God has sent a number of representatives of him into the world. And the people, the descendants of Abraham, are in a sense representatives of God. They play a unique role. They do, in a sense, represent God among us as human beings. But there have been other representatives of God. And if we think about that, I think it, to a certain extent, I think it helps us to think about the Jews. The best example of God's representation among us is Jesus. And that is, it's an amazing thing to think that God came and was in our midst. That God translated himself into a human being and then was born as a child, was born as a helpless infant, grew up in our midst, and was there, and you would think that everybody would recognize godness. You would think that people would say, oh my goodness, look what we've got in our midst. But that was not what happened. That what happened was people missed it. They didn't see him for who he was. And I think that's largely because the godness that was there is not a godness that we were expecting. It wasn't the godness that we want to see. That the godness that we saw was a character, a moral character that was visible and there in our midst. And that's not very recognizable. We would rather have seen power. We would rather have seen something more dramatic, more fanfare, more something more blatant. As a result, the response of people was either to ignore him or despise him. And as you know, he was ultimately put to death. But how one responds to Jesus, or how one responded to Jesus, is indicative of how one responds to God, because Jesus was God translated into human form. So I would like to think that had we been there, we would have recognized the godness of Jesus. But he was perfect. He was sinless. What if he hadn't been sinless? Then would we have been justified in ignoring him? Another set of representatives of God that have come and been in our midst are the prophets. Maybe that's a little bit better example, because they were human beings like us. They were sinners. They were people who spoke God's words. They spoke for God. So in that sense, they were representative of God. And what was the response to them? Stephen, in his speech in Acts 7, in verse 52, he says, which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? That the consistent response of the of the Jews to the prophets was to persecute them, not recognize the godness of the message that they bore. Okay, so now, if we talk about the Jews, I think they're somewhat analogous. That is to say, my understanding of the Jews and the role that they play in history is that God chose them to be the unique vehicle through whom he revealed himself to the rest of mankind. So there's a sense in which they, as a culture, they as a nation, are representative of God and what he wants to us to understand about him. And the way I think about it, the Jews are in this grand story that God is telling, which is human history. In this grand story that God is telling, the Jews are essentially the hero of the story. They're the protagonist. That if we were readers of the book of the history of mankind, that our attention ought to be on the Jews, be on that particular group of people, because they play a unique role in the story, a uniquely important role in the story. And I think that what we are to understand as believers is that there is honor that is due to them for the role that they play. That there's some sense in which we ought to be cheering for them. We ought to be pulling for them to play the role that God has assigned them to play. To play the role that God has ultimately assigned them to play, that he gave them to play. That is, to be a nation that embodies godliness here on earth. I think that it is possible to look at Jews or the nation of Israel and be either indifferent or even wish that they were not. That wouldn't the world be a simpler place if they were not? In fact, and this is just guessing, but just kind of looking at history and thinking about things, I'm inclined to think that at some point in history, we are going to be faced with a devil's bargain. And that is, we are going to have to choose between the preservation of Jews or world peace. Which do you want? And that we will have to make that choice. And if that ever comes to pass, I think we as believers have no option. There's no option there. The choice has to be that we will not sacrifice this people for the sake of world peace. Okay, I was going to do one other thing, but I think I'll save that because there's not much time left. So, questions or comments?
I wasn't going to ask my question, but since no one else is, I guess I'll go for it. You often speak about the Gentile believers and then the Jews. Are we to assume that Jewish believers are lumped in with Gentile believers when you're talking into those two groups?
What do you mean?
Did I say Jewish believers? That's what I meant to say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's, you know, at least half a dozen, if not a dozen, Jewish Christians in this church community. Mm-hmm. So when you're speaking about Gentile believers, you would lump us in with you, right?
In what I was saying.
It doesn't matter.
I don't think it matters in what I was saying. What I was saying is that our attitude towards the descendants of Abraham ought to be of a certain nature.
So do you view it as an us and them thing? I mean, when you do the us and them thing, I get confused because I don't know which group I'm in. I kind of feel like I'm in both. I mean, I don't live in Israel, but I kind of feel like I'm in both.
Right, and I think that's true. You are in both. Yeah, which is quite a privilege.